the great fundamental issue now before our people can be stated briefly. It is, are the American people fit to govern themselves, to rule themselves, to control themselves? I believe they are. My opponents do not. I believe in the right of the people to rule. I believe again that the American people are as a whole capable of self-control and of learning by their mistakes.
Welcome to the Serve to Lead podcast. I'm your host, James Strock. As we get started, may I ask a favor? Please help us reach a growing audience by subscribing and giving us a high rating on iTunes. Today, it's a special honor to have General H.R. McMaster on the Serve to Lead podcast. No one better exemplifies the Serve to Lead ideals. The general is perhaps best known for his service as the 26th National Security Advisor to the President in 2017 to 2018. This was a capstone to a storied military career. A West Point graduate, General McMaster served in the U.S. Army for 34 years, including tours in theater in Afghanistan and Iraq. He's also a highly regarded historian and holds a Ph.D. from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Now based at Stanford University, General McMaster is the author of an important new book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World. General H.R. McMaster, welcome to the Serve to Lead podcast.
James, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
General, what was your main inspiration in writing your new book, Battlegrounds, The Fight to Defend the Free World?
James, I think it's important that all Americans understand the crucial challenges we face, challenges that are relevant to our security, our freedom, and our prosperity. And what I hope with the book, what the book will do is help generate a deeper understanding of those challenges as a basis for, you know, for civil, meaningful discussions about how we can build a better future for generations to come.
Well, the book is certainly selling well and has tremendous reviews, and it's uniquely accessible to all kinds of readers with your skillful mixing of your own direct experience with your knowledge of theory and history. I'd like to turn for a moment, if we can, General, to some of those big picture items that you have thought about so much. 75 years ago, the U.S. led in the construction of what came to be called the liberal world order. The Bretton Woods financial arrangements, the GI Bill, the linked international and trade efforts, the multilateral security institutions, all of these have yielded great benefits to the U.S. and to the world. But now, in a new time, in a new world, how should we think about those existing arrangements and begin to update them?
Well, James, I think the most important thing is to recognize that we have to compete. We have to compete to maintain an order that's beneficial not only to the United States, but other free societies, and I would say all of humanity. As you mentioned, there are tremendous achievements in the post World War II era, but those were not uncontested, and they were contested, of course, most significantly in the context of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. And James, the story that I tell in Battlegrounds is that after the breakup of the Soviet Union, the victory in the Cold War, we became overconfident, and that overconfident led to complacency. And so now this order on which we have relied for so long is under duress because great power competition has returned, and we face significant challenges by authoritarian and closed systems that threaten our freedom, our security, and the prosperity of our free and open societies.
Well, looking back 30 years to 1990, there was a major world-changing event with the unification or reunification of East and West Germany. And let me give you a critical view some people have expressed. Looking back with the benefit of hindsight, one could argue that was a high point for American geopolitical power, our moral force, our capacity to envision and enact a national strategy, our economic and financial power, and our belief in ourselves. Since that time, some would suggest we've not tended to our national position intelligently, and various vulnerabilities are appearing as a result. How would you respond to that take?
I would in general agree with that because of this overconfidence of the 1990s that led to complacency and the belief in three assumptions that turned out to be demonstrably false now. The first of those is that the arc of history had guaranteed the primacy of our free and open societies over closed authoritarian systems. Related to that was the assumption that the great power competition was a relic of the past. And then the combination of both the victory in the Cold War, as well as the overwhelming military victory over Saddam Hussein's army in the 1991 Gulf War, I think convinced many that our security was guaranteed by America's technological military prowess. Of course, in the 2000s, we were set up for some significant disappointments because those assumptions turned out to be false, especially in connection with the mass murder attacks of September 11th, 2001, during which terrorists bypassed our tremendous military strength and used box cutters and airplanes to commit the most devastating terrorist attack in history. And then we had the unanticipated length and difficulty of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which further shook our confidence. And I think we were set up for that because of the belief among many that those wars would be fast, cheap, and be able to wage those efficiently, and that we could withdraw rapidly from those conflicts. And then the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis. So, James, I think what happened is that the emotional impetus behind our foreign policy shifted from that over-optimism of the 90s to deep pessimism and almost resignation, and among some, a belief that our disengagement from complex challenges overseas is an unmitigated good.
Let's go to your knowledge of history for a moment. President Eisenhower, in addition to being one of the great military leaders of the Second World War, was an often underestimated politician, more appreciated with the passage of time. Eisenhower warned as he left office in 1960 what he called a military-industrial complex. And an early draft of that speech reportedly would have termed it the military-industrial congressional complex. How do you evaluate Ike's diagnosis and prognosis in our very different world 60 years on?
Well, I would say that it's still alive and well, James. and in fact, paradoxically, at times when defense budgets shrink, the military-industrial complex can be even more influential as they fight over dwindling dollars for procurement. And this complex is, of course, it's the defense industry, it's the defense establishment and the Pentagon in particular, it's Congress, but I would add it's certain think tanks as well, who I think define the challenges to our security in ways that do neglect the agency that the other has over the future course of events, but the agency that the other has in the context of not just strategic competitions, but in the war as well, right? I mean, by a friend of mine, the historian Conrad Crane, has said that there are two ways to fight the U.S. military, or to fight just generally, asymmetrically and stupidly. Your enemy picks stupidly, but they're unlikely to do so. So we tend to prepare for the war we would prefer rather than the range of challenges to our security that exist already. And I'm afraid we might be on the path to doing that again as we make an absolutely wholly appropriate and much needed and overdue adjustment to recognizing great power competition, especially with China. It was increased its defense budget 800% since 1992. I think it could be the greatest peacetime buildup, military buildup in at least modern history. And so there are real reasons to focus on great power competition, but we still also have non-state actors and jihadist terrorists.
When you talk about balance of power politics, General, the United States arguably asserted regional hegemony in the Americas, beginning with the Monroe Doctrine that was intended to block the European powers from additional colonial claims in our neighborhood. Theodore Roosevelt later added a corollary, basically an enforcement notion, warning off the European powers from abusing infrastructure, investment, or debt claims as pretext for intervention. What's the status of the Monroe Doctrine today?
Well, I think there are different forms of competition emerging. Of course, the Monroe Doctrine, I think in many ways, was extremely positive because it prevented European countries from maintaining colonial or servile relationships with the countries of the Western Hemisphere. And what I think we see today are new and in many ways more pernicious forms of aggression and subversion. And in particular, China's efforts to use the so-called One Belt, One Road strategy to set a debt trap for countries and then to use that debt trap to first co-opt these countries into their circle and coerce them to adhere to China's agenda in the area of foreign policy, and to essentially become a version of a client state, and then conceal these activities as just normal business practices. This is why in Ecuador, you know, for example, the Chinese built a multi-billion dollar dam project that immediately began to crack, that the turbines clogged with silt. The first time it was turned on, it blew out the entire power grid in Ecuador. But in exchange, China got Ecuador's full amount of oil exports at a reduced price, and they got a lot of influence. Now, the government that entered into that corrupt deal is now out of power. Many officials in that government have been prosecuted and convicted. But it's just one example in the Western Hemisphere of how China is working very hard to extend its influence. Now, of course, the most dramatic examples are in the failing states of Nicaragua, of Venezuela, as well as the dictatorship in Cuba.
Let's take this a step further. Some apologists for China might argue that they're moving toward their own Monroe Doctrine of sorts in East Asia. Hong Kong is increasingly openly subjugated, being brought within the Chinese system. There's concern that China might be tempted to forcibly annex Taiwan. What do you see coming in this respect, and how should the United States frame this issue of regional hegemony, in effect, that's being contested in these various areas?
Well, I think what you see now in a way that it is really undeniable is that China is exporting its authoritarian mercantilist model in a way that disadvantages our free and open societies and our free market economic system. And I think the most important way to frame this is, first of all, to make clear this is not a United States-China problem. This is a free world-China problem. And if you look at how the Chinese Communist Party has in many ways foisted the COVID-19 pandemic on the world by suppressing the warnings of human-to-human transmission, by punishing the doctors who were trying to raise the alarm, by shutting down domestic travel before they shut down international travel, by subverting the World Health Organization, and then, of course, adding insult to injury with the so-called wolf warrior diplomacy oriented mainly on Europe, Australia, and the United States, and engaging in a range of aggression during the pandemic, including massive cyber attacks on our medical research facilities and pharmaceutical companies in the middle of a pandemic, massive cyber attacks across all sectors within Australia, as you already mentioned, the national security law, the repression of human freedom in Hong Kong, attacking Indian forces on the Himalayan border and bludgeoning Indian soldiers to death as they claim more territory there, endeavoring to accomplish the largest land grab, so to speak, in history in the South China Sea, ramming Malaysian and Vietnamese vessels there. This is all just during the pandemic. And also, as you mentioned, the threatening language and actions oriented on Taiwan as well as on Japan's Senkaku Islands. So I think this is an extremely dangerous period of time. I think Taiwan is the most dangerous flashpoint, as I mentioned, in battlegrounds. And it's really going to take the free world working together to deter Chinese aggression, to deter Xi Jinping, who is motivated mainly by fear of losing control. And this is why you see him extending and tightening his exclusive grip on power, the party's exclusive grip on power, engaging in a campaign of cultural genocide in Xinjiang, perfecting this technologically enabled Orwellian surveillance state inside of China, throwing out Western reporters, building the information and digital firewall even higher. It's a dangerous time, and China, I think, always believed the Chinese Communist Party did. It had a fleeting window of opportunity to take center stage, to establish exclusion on the areas of privacy across the Indo-Pacific region, to isolate, to push the United States out, to isolate its regional competitor and rival, Japan. And I think you see the party acting to do all this in a very aggressive manner.
In the end, how far will it be possible for the United States and allies to protect Hong Kong if China is hell-bent upon incorporating it, given where it's located. And in the event these kind of things happen, should the U.S. and other countries simultaneously be working on, for example, preferential immigration rules? That's a spectacular amount of human talent that China's putting at risk.
I think, James, you've just put your finger on what I think was a very important policy. Now, you've seen the U.K. Do this, and I think the U.S. And others should join in as well. You know, I'm reminded, and I tell the story in Battlegrounds, of after the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, President George H.W. Bush told all the Chinese students who were in the United States, if you're in the United States and with a student visa, you can have a green card and stay here. 58,000 Chinese students, and remember back then, it was a very small number of Chinese students compared to today. 58,000 took him up on it, and they're some of our greatest citizens. They're some of our most successful entrepreneurs. So I think this is an important move. I would also recommend, James, that companies, U.S. companies, whose employees, Chinese employees in China, are subjected to the coercive power of the Chinese Communist Party, that those employees and their families also be granted something like a special benefit parole visa, or an H-1B visa from the United States.
General, let me ask you a question that you're very familiar with. Critics believe that the United States is basically in a fatigued state from its international commitments. How do you think about that, and what lessons do we have to be really taking to make ourselves a credible and effective war-making power when it's necessary in the new world we're in?
Well, it's important to point out that the war in Afghanistan was initiated after the most devastating terrorist attacks in history, and was authorized by the U.S. Congress. So was the Iraq invasion in 2003. And I think while we debate oftentimes, you know, whether or not we should have invaded Iraq, it's often a topic of conversation. And I write in Battlegrounds about this, you know, this orthodoxy of the revolution in military affairs that, you know, that really gained a lot of credence and a lot of following in the 1990s after the victory in the Gulf War. And I think it was based in large measure on a misinterpretation of the 1991 Gulf War, and in particular, the neglect of, you know, the ineptitude of Saddam Hussein's forces, as well as the neglect of how narrowly circumscribed the political objective was. It was just, hey, give Kuwait back to the Kuwaitis. And as you know, we remained engaged in Iraq to contain Saddam, for the ensuing decade. And the invasion of 2003, I think, was, of course, controversial, but I think what's most important about it, and about the war in Afghanistan, is that this short-term approach, the short-term fast war mentality, actually lengthened and complicated those wars. I know the American people are understandably frustrated with the length of the war in Afghanistan, but it's not an almost 20-year war. It's a one-year war 20 times over. So I argue in the book that we have to pay particular attention to continuities in the nature of war. Otherwise, we will violate what the Prussian philosopher Karl von Clausewitz said is the first rule for a statesman or a stateswoman, which is to not try to turn a war into something alien to its nature. And this is, of course, this tendency towards strategic narcissism, you know, to define the war as we would like it to be, to conjure the enemies to who we would like to fight, instead of the actual enemies, like the Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan, and this disastrous approach toward a peace plan and withdrawal from Afghanistan. So I think the emphasis has to be on restoring our strategic competence, with an emphasis on these continuities in the nature of war. That war is political, war is human, war is uncertain, and therefore there's not anything ever like linear progress in war, which is the interaction with your enemies and adversaries and complex environments. And then, of course, war is a contest of wills. And that improved competence is essential, because we do have to strengthen our will and essentially our confidence in our ability to fight and achieve sustainable outcomes consistent with our vital interests in war. But also we need confidence to sustain a sensible an engaged foreign policy.
General, if we could stay on Afghanistan for one moment, Stars and Stripes, the U.S. military news service, has profiled families where parents who served in Afghanistan are now seeing their children return to the same war. How long do you think the U.S. should be deployed there? What are the criteria for success the public should focus on? And what would you say to those families or people that are uncomfortable with a multi-generational family commitment of that nature?
Well, you know, I would say, first of all, there just are not short-term solutions to long-term problems. And sadly, we're facing a long-term problem of jihadist terrorism that we paid the price for thinking that it wasn't a threat to us when in 1998, remember, President Bill Clinton fired a few cruise missiles and called it a day against Al-Qaeda. These are very dangerous groups. These are groups that I believe are more dangerous today than they were on September 10, 2001. And that's because they're orders of magnitude larger. It was the Mujahideen alumni of the resistance to Soviet occupation of Afghanistan who committed the mass murders of September 11. The Al-Qaeda and the ISIS alumni are now orders of magnitude greater. Many of these groups, at least 20 of them, exist in this terrorist ecosystem on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. And remember, these are groups that already want to commit mass murder against us as their principal tactic, I believe, is all civilized peoples, right? And it's an important insurance policy for us to work really mainly through partners to ensure that these terrorist organizations don't gain the strength and control of territory and populations and resources, the ability to recruit and execute those attacks against us. And while that requires a sustained commitment, including in Afghanistan, for example, 8,500 troops, I think it is now, that's more than sustainable. And what it is enabling is our courageous Afghan forces taking the brunt of the fight to preserve the freedoms that they've enjoyed since the end of the Taliban regime in 2001. I'll just tell you that this year in Afghanistan, for example, 10 courageous American heroes gave the last full measure, the ultimate sacrifice for our security. But every day in Afghanistan, 30 Afghan soldiers or police are killed defending their country from some of the most heinous people on earth. And so I think that's worth the sustained commitment. I would also point out, James, that you know we have sustained these commitments in the past to good effect.
General, your evocative concept of strategic narcissism, that's a keystone to your important new book, has echoes of other imperial powers in history. You know, the rise and decline, for example, of the British Empire. What lessons are there for the United States from other countries' experiences of this nature?
Well, I think the first observation to make is that we're not a colonial power. Right? We have no interest in creating servile relationships with countries so we can draw them into our orbit and take a mercantilist approach to commerce and trade in which we benefit in a one-sided way, right? And I think what we can do is strengthen our reputation by remaining an example to those who want to help themselves achieve a representative form of government, to achieve rule of law, to live in a society that is tolerant of one another. We have work to do in our own country in these areas, but I think America has been, I know America has been, and will remain an example for countries and for peoples who want to strengthen their own democracies. And I think that makes them worthy of our support. And in many ways, supporting those who want to effect change in their own countries to ensure that their people have a say in how they're governed, to not worry about arbitrary violence or detention, but instead live in a country that has due process of law, to be in a country that is tolerant of religious differences and racial and tribal and sexual preference. And I think all of these countries are worth supporting, not only because it's consistent with the rights that are laid out in our Declaration of Independence and our Bill of Rights, or the UN Universal Declaration on Human Rights, but because it's the best way to counter our competitors, especially these authoritarian states like China that are promoting corrupt authoritarian regimes, not only just in the region of the Indo-Pacific, but globally.
If strategic narcissism has among its effects a brittleness in making the nation's view of war and its perhaps declining capacity to think entrepreneurial or opportunistically, is it thereby tied intimately to the tremendous influence of special interests of all types in Washington now? That is to say, can this be dealt with separate from broader political reform, or do you view it in a different way?
Well, I think political reform is important to our strategic competence, and so is moving away from the vitriolic partisan discourse. What I try to do in the book is describe these challenges and make recommendations on how to overcome them in a way that's nonpartisan. And I think we ought to remember, I mentioned just the mass murder attacks of September 11th. When Al-Qaeda attacked, they didn't attack Democrats or Republicans. They attacked Americans. And so I think that if there is hope of reversing the polarization that we see in political life in the United States, to come together to have discussions about how we can build a better future for our children and grandchildren. I don't think anybody should be against that.
General Heraclitus wrote that character is destiny. Believe that America's strength is founded on what he called the national character. And he believed those virtues were the foundation of self-government, that all the laws and wealth one could have would be of no value over time unless that national character was tended to. What is your thought on that topic?
Well, I'm worried about it, James. I think what we're seeing today, to some extent, with the murder of George Floyd and the racial and social divides laid bare by that horrible act, is that we've lost confidence in large measure. Confidence in who we are as Americans, a more common or a broader identity. And I think this is the result, in part, of an interaction between what some people call identity politics with bigotry and racism. I think it's in many ways the end of our ability to empathize with one another. And I lay the blame in part to education, to the lack of or misguided civics education and education in our history. I think it should be possible for Americans to take pride in our founding and the radical idea that sovereignty lies with the American people, and still be disappointed that it took us nearly 100 years to remove the greatest blight on our history, which is the institution of slavery. But then also celebrate that we did emancipate, our forebears did, emancipated 4 million people in our most destructive war in history. But then again, of course, recognize the failure of Reconstruction, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, of Jim Crow and separate but equal. But it's a continuous struggle, a struggle that in many ways had a great amount of progress in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement and the dismantlement of de jure segregation and inequality of opportunity. We have to recognize that we still have de facto inequality of opportunity. And so I think this pride, national pride, not based in a contrived happy view of our history, but in an accurate view of our history that helps restore confidence that we as Americans, we have a tremendous advantage. We have a say in how we're governed. We can affect change if we want to, by coming together, developing an agenda and working together to achieve our goals and objectives. I quote Richard Rorty in Battlegrounds, who observed that national pride in a country is like self-respect in an individual, a necessary ingredient for self-improvement. And so I think we ought to maybe make a concerted effort to restore our national pride and then work together on these big issues that have come to the fore in this crazy year of 2020, educational reform, really going after inequality of opportunity, and I think we can do it. I think when you study, for example, really the roots of segregated neighborhoods and neighborhoods in which children get an inferior education just because of the zip code they're born in. You see that these were set up, and these were set up by, you know, by color line type laws and policies. And so if that's the case, then good policies can reverse, you know, reverse those situations and make all of America stronger and restore confidence among all Americans in the American dream and the recognition that if in this country, if you work hard, if you contribute to your community, you can build a better life for yourself and your children and your grandchildren.
General, as a military officer, as an author of highly regarded books, Dereliction of Duty and Now Battlegrounds, as a lecturer, a red or golden thread through your illustrious career is that you're an educator. What do you seek to impart to young people in their 20s as they look ahead in this very uncertain moment?
Well, I got my affinity for education from my mother, who taught for 35 years in inner city Philadelphia and was just a wonderful educator. And I would just say for young people in your 20s, look for an opportunity to serve. And this is, James, why I love your podcast and that connects these podcasts. There are tremendous rewards in serving your fellow citizens and humanity. And there are tremendous opportunities to do so within the military, which is the path that I took. But there are many other paths as well. Two of our daughters, for example, did Teach for America and had a wonderful experience there. And so I just think as a young person, look for an opportunity to serve your community, your fellow Americans, humanity. And I think it will open doors for you that will make you a better citizen. But then also, I think, give you an experience that you can take pride in for the rest of your life.
General, if you could do so today, what would you tell the 20-year-old H.R. McMaster?
Well, I would just say, maybe, hey, it's all going to work out fine. because I mean, I feel really, just so fortunate that I've had the experiences that I've had in our Army and in national service. And nothing worked out, James, as I'd planned. When I graduated from West Point, I was commissioned in aviation. And they found astigmatism in my eye, and they said, okay, well, now you're an armor and cavalry officer. And I thought, well, I'd actually rather be infantry. Can I go to Fort Benning? No, doesn't make sense. You're already at Fort Knox. You're an armor and cavalry officer. Well, I'm glad I'm an armor and cavalry officer. I said, okay, well, how about then going to Europe, the forward war? And they said, sure, thanks for your input. Fort Hood, Texas, it is. Every single worked out, really not as I had planned or hoped, but in retrospect, I wouldn't have changed a thing. And when I talk to young people today, oftentimes I get a sense that they want to map out, their whole lives. And I would just say, do something that's challenging, that's fun, that allows you to experience these less tangible rewards of serving others. And it will all work out.
Are there significant matters relating to leadership that you've changed your mind about over time?
Well, I don't know if I've changed my mind about much on leadership. I think it really comes down to, first and foremost, what is your base motivation in whatever organization you're in or leading any particular organization? If it's the mission, if it's bigger than yourself, if it's caring for those that are in your organization based on a genuine concern for them to have a positive experience, and not just in the workplace, but have such a good positive experience that it carries over their personal lives as well. If you have fun, building teams that are cohesive and bound together by mutual respect and common purpose, I think that's the right motivation for a leader. Sometimes you see leaders who are actually leading because they want to get the next job, or they want to look good, or they want to advance their own interests. And those are leaders, who tend to be toxic or ineffective. So I think it really comes down to assessing what is your base motivation. And I think that's the foundation for either effective or ineffective leadership.
In addition to Battlegrounds and Dereliction of Duty, are there books or other creative works that have been especially influential upon you that you would suggest for others?
You know, James, there's a recommended reading section in the back of the book, because what I'm hoping is that Battlegrounds will spark people's intellectual curiosity, their challenges, and I want Battlegrounds to be part of an ongoing discussion about how to build a better future for generations to come.
Well, General Clare Booth Luce famously instructed John Kennedy that everyone, even presidents, are ultimately encapsulated in a single sentence. What would you like your one sentence to be?
I would just say, servant of the nation. I think that's what all of us should aspire to do, to make a contribution to our fellow men and women, and to helpfully leave a better world, for your children. And now we have 1-year-old grandchildren. So I think that's what we all maybe ought to have in mind.
H.R. McMaster, how can listeners best follow and connect with you in social media?
Well, I have been drug into the 21st century by my daughter. So I'm on Twitter and Instagram at LTGHR McMaster.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, General H.R. McMaster. It's been an honor and a delight to have you with us today. And thank you for your service and leadership.
James, thank you, and thanks for the great gift of this wonderful podcast. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
And thanks to you, our listeners, for being with us. Please send me ideas for future guests and topics, and follow us on Twitter at James Strock, and connect via our website, Serve to Lead. Until next time, take care, be strong, and serve to lead.
These are not dark days. These are great days. The greatest our country has ever lived. And we must all thank God that we have been allowed, each of us, according to our station, to play a part in making these days memorable in the history of our race.